If I can begin by saying this is actually only the second time on which Anthony and I have shared a stage. On the opening night of the Festival Theatre in 1973, as Anthony was coming on stage as the last of the tenors in the choir for Beethoven's Ninth, I was coming on the other side as the last of the basses. And 37 years later, I'm finally getting a chance to find out things about Anthony Steele, some of which are in his astonishingly informative and ever so slightly racy anecdotal autobiography, and some of which are not. Anthony, as the world's greatest nanny said, let's start at the very beginning. It's a very good place to start. Were you born into a family where the arts, music, theatre, for example, were a significant factor?
Yes and no. My immediate forebears, who feature in the first chapter of the book, had nothing to do with the arts at all. I can't go on about them, but the main guy there was sold fish off a box in the street for a living. And then he became a bookie on the racecourse. And then he became the richest and most famous bookie in England. And he became Edward VII's bookie, who spent a lot of his time on the racecourse, and he made a very great deal of money. And when he retired from the turf, his friends said to him, and he went back to live in Sheffield, because he'd moved to London, of course. He went back to live in Sheffield, which is where we all came from. His friends said to him, your name's Steele, you live in Sheffield, you'd better buy a steelworks. So he did. And that was the beginning of the family firm, which by the time I was able to understand anything that was going on in the world, was a very considerable organization. It had 40,000 employees, and my father was the managing director of it. So that's going on very quickly, two generations. But at the same time, my mother, who came from a completely different background, she trained to be a pianist, and she was going to be a professional pianist, but of course in those days, once you got married, that was the end of all that. And so I imagine that most of my musical knowledge, because that was my first introduction to the arts in general, came from her. Then my sisters, both brothers-in-law, became professional musicians, and so it kind of rolled on, but I think that's where it all began.
And was there ever the opportunity, the possibility that you might have followed the family footsteps into industry as opposed to going into the arts?
There not only was, but there was, because I worked for the family firm for 5 miserable years. My father had just died, just at the moment that I had to decide to do what I was going to do with my life. I had no particular ambition because I'd been brought up frankly, in very, very privileged circumstances. I'd been to the best public school, I'd been to Oxford, I'd been, as Anne suggested, also to Cambridge, although that came a bit later. And during none of that time did I do any work at all, because nobody told me that it was necessary to do so, I suppose. And when it came to the point that I had to earn a living of some kind, it seemed to me that the steel firm was there. My father just died, so everybody else who was in a position of importance in the firm felt a particular responsibility towards me. So I joined the firm. It was a very silly thing to do. And yet, looking back on it, it wasn't that stupid, because it was an immensely enjoyable, in a funny way, 5 years. I met so many people that I would never have had a chance to meet in my privileged circumstances otherwise. And there are a lot of rather rude stories about that in the book. And it was only because after 5 years of drudgery I realized that this wasn't for me that the most extraordinary thing happened. I was posted to a branch of our firm in the northwest of England on the edge of the Lake District, which I particularly loved. And whilst I was there, not doing anything useful for the firm, I'm afraid, I met a wonderful Hungarian refugee called Mickey Seckers. Mickey had gone to live in that part of the world because there were special conditions for people who were refugees and had a bit of money. And he founded what became the most famous silk firm in the United Kingdom. And he also, because he was, I think largely because he was on the board of the Glyndebourne Festival Opera, he decided that he would like to start something very, very modest of the same kind in his garden. So he had Oliver Messel, the greatest stage designer of the time, to design a theatre for him that seated about, I don't know, maybe 150, and he opened for business. Most of his artists were musicians rather than actors, although there was a bit of a mixture. I became an habitué of this place and became great friends with Mickey and the family. And cut a long story short, after I'd been promoted back to Sheffield because I made a hideous mistake in the northwest of England, so they wanted to get rid of me out of there, so I was promoted back to Sheffield, I realized that this wasn't for me. And whenever I had a weekend off, I would drive up to Cumberland and go to a concert or performance at Rose Hill, as it was called. And on one of these occasions, very late in the evening, when Mickey and I were probably into our fourth or fifth glass of cognac, everyone else had gone to bed, Mickey said to me, "You know that I'm chairman of a chamber orchestra called the London Mozart Players?" And I said, "Yes, of course I do." He said, "You've got friends in musical circles, and their administration is in a terrible mess. Do you know anyone who would like to run them?" And I said, "Yes, I would." A month later, I was living on a houseboat in Chelsea. I was driving one of those wonderful little sardine can Citroen 2CVs. I had grown a beard, and I was running the London Mozart Players.
And evidently, you ran the London Mozart Players with a bit more success than you had your branch of the family steel firm. Smaller numbers, of course, 20 to 25 as opposed to 40,000. Brass as opposed to steel. But I'm really interested in the other thing that happened at about this time. At the height of the Cold War, you went off to learn Russian. This is not inexplicable, because you're about to explain how it came about, but I'm fascinated by it. Great culture, great literature, great music, of course, but why Russian? If you had a Hungarian friend, why not Hungarian?
Hungarian's a ghastly language. No, all languages are beautiful, if the truth be known. I mean that. But I had a Polish girlfriend, and Polish, which is a beautiful language, I assure you. What happened was that in those days, an awful long time ago, everyone in England had to do national service in the Army or the Navy or the Air Force. I got out of it because I had a history of asthma as a child, so I went straight from school at the age of 18 to Oxford. By the time I finished at Oxford 4 years later, the wretched people had changed the rules, and I was required to do national service. But, as it turned out, they had no intention of allowing me to become an officer because I had a low medical grade due to this history of asthma. So when I discovered this, I rang up my father, who had friends in all kinds of high places, and I said, this won't do. I'm not going to crawl about on my stomach with a rifle for the next 18 months. Do something about it. And he discovered this incredible course, which had been set up by the Prime Minister, no less, and Clement Attlee, because this was indeed, as you say, at the height of the Cold War, and they needed people who spoke Russian well enough to be translators, interpreters, even spies, although that never happened to me. And so I went on this course for 18 months, and instead of crawling about on my stomach with a rifle, I learnt Russian for 12 of those months at Cambridge University in civilian clothes, being paid as a regular soldier, which meant £5 a week. Unthought of riches compared with the stipend of a national serviceman. And at the end of that time, we spoke very good Russian indeed, and we were ready to do what we had to do, except by then our national service was over, so we were demobilized, and that was the end of that.
But it did leave you with a wonderful weapon, a wonderful tool for dealing with Russian bureaucracy, Russian performers, Russian musicians.
Yes, it did. The steel firm allowed me to go on a couple of jaunts, one to Brussels for the 1957 World Fair, and the other to an enormous British trade fair in a park on the outskirts of Moscow. And I interpreted at both of those, excuse me, and met Khrushchev along the way and spoke to him in very peculiar circumstances that I won't bore you with. And eventually I got to know in London, when I was with the Mozart Players, some of the greatest Soviet musicians who were just beginning to be allowed out of their country. And by greatest Soviet musicians at that time, of course, I mean the greatest musicians, period. One of the ones who became the closest friend was Mstislav Rostropovich, the extraordinary cellist. And he was a very naughty man.
Ah, yes, Anthony, I wonder if you would care to read, starting at the top of the second paragraph on page 65.
I'll do whatever I'm told. On one such occasion, I agreed to meet Mstislav Rostropovich at Heathrow and take him to his Kensington Hotel. This hotel was not the best address in London, but Victor, that's his agent, in London, tried not to waste more money on such things than was necessary. As we were driving out of the airport, Slava asked me where he was staying. The usual place, I said. He refused point blank to go there and insisted that I take him to the Thames houseboat where I was living and where he proposed to spend the night. He strictly forbade me to tell Victor of the change of plan. When we got home, he took his priceless cello out of the car and carried it unsteadily over the swaying gangways into the boat. Slava slept the sleep of the just with his cello beside him and my cat on top of the cello. In the morning, a furious Victor was on the phone early, demanding to know where Slava was. I confessed, and he said he would be round immediately to collect him. When he arrived, still seething with anger, he pulled the door with such force that it came off its hinges, and only by the greatest good fortune did he not plunge overboard into the river. That afternoon, before he finally agreed with his tail somewhat between his legs to go to his Kensington Hotel, Slava invited Marion Lady Harwood to tea. Marion, George's wife at the time and an accomplished pianist, was a close friend of the Rostropovich's, especially Slava, and a bit of an Aldborough groupie. She was, after all, the daughter of Erwin Stein, who had been Britain's editor at Boosey and Hawkes, and thus one of his most trusted musical associates. It was a still, close, muggy London summer day. Slava had taken off all his clothes and was lying on the sofa when there was a knock at the door. I warned Slava that this would be Marion. I kept her outside on the gangplank for a few minutes, chatting about the mooring, which never failed to fascinate first-time visitors, in order to give Slava a chance to get dressed. Then I took her through to the end room. Slava was still lying on the sofa naked, but had managed to knot a tie round his neck.
Elsewhere in the book, Anthony, you make the point that London at this time, from the late 50s into the 60s, as it was becoming swinging London, was a marvellous place to be in terms of the variety, the depth, the calibre of the arts world in which you found yourself. Who were the people there who made the greatest impact on you?
What a question. Practically the whole scene, really. I mean, London at that time, without any doubt at all, was the arts capital of the world. And I kind of sniffed it out, I suppose. I can't particularly recall special people, apart from those musicians, not only Russian musicians, but others. I first came across dance in my life because I was a complete neophyte about all these things. When the Merce Cunningham Dance Company came to London and I saw them and was bowled over. In theatre, I lived very near to Sloane Square, that's where the boat was moored, not far from there. And the Royal Court Theatre in Sloane Square was the heart of the best of new English writing for the theatre at that time, people like John Osborne, for example. And I soaked all that up. But, of course, this wasn't my job. My job was to run a small chamber orchestra, which is a very insignificant and easy thing to do, really. So I was soaking all this up subconsciously, I suppose. And in fact, when I was writing the book, one of the things that came most vividly to me was that it was that time in London when I suddenly realized that I was learning all these things that I hadn't appreciated at the time that I was learning. It was a remarkable place to be at that particular time. One thing I should add is that is, of course, when the sexual revolution, as I believe it's called, took place in London. In that place, at that time, that passed me by completely. But when I came to Adelaide in the 70s, Adelaide was just catching up. So I took full advantage of it in that decade rather than the 60s.
Among the things that you were soaking up in this time in London was the ability to run something a little larger than the London Mozart Players, a small chamber orchestra. Was there a moment when your ambition, your sense of yourself as an art professional, tipped over or opened out to a grander scale?
Yes, there was, and we can leave London quickly at this point. And I moved from the London Mozart Players to the London Symphony Orchestra, where I didn't have all that happy. I wasn't the boss. Didn't have all that happy a time. And then I went to work at the Royal Festival Hall. And one of the great things that happened to me there, I was employed, by the way, because the Queen Elizabeth Hall and the Purcell Room, the two smaller halls in that complex, had just been built. And they needed somebody to manage the programming of all three halls. It wasn't all that tricky, actually, because there were far more people wanting to hire the places than there were dates available. Nevertheless, that was my job. And suddenly, my boss, who was otherwise not a, well, he was a slightly mundane person, but he did have one very great idea, and that is that during the summer, what do you do in those halls? Because the proms are on at the Albert Hall, most people are away on holiday, there's no point in presenting anything. And he had this great idea that in the Queen Elizabeth Hall, which is a 1,000-seat concert hall, we should present something that he called South Bank Summer Music. And Daniel Barenboim, who was then 24 or something, was engaged as the first, it wasn't called director, I forget for a moment what it was called, but he was basically the director of this fortnight of music, and he brought all his friends together, and I was his right-hand person. So I did all the boring work, and he had the ideas. And of course, it was the most astonishing experience for me. And after this had gone on, after Daniel had done 3 years, my boss had a rather bright idea that we would slightly change the emphasis and invited Gerald Moore, the great accompanist, to be the director, whatever it was called, for the next one. It was called South Bank Summer Song. And I got along very well with Gerald and enjoyed that enormously. After that was over, or during that time, I think, I decided that I was about to be 40 years old. And I thought it's high time that I was boss of whatever I was doing, which I wasn't, obviously, at the Festival Hall. And then, by an extraordinary series of circumstances, I met Lena Mardio, who was running the arts department in South Australia at the time, and then eventually caught up with Don Dunstan in London, and things happened.
Before we get on to the things that happened, Anthony, and I think many people here are aware of many of them, what were you offered by the South Australian government that made you give up London, the centre of the arts world, to travel 12,000 miles to a city which didn't really even have a large concert hall, a couple of theatres?
There are two answers to that. The first is that I applied for the job running the Sydney Opera House. And in fact, my ex, no, he wasn't my boss, but somebody I knew well who had been deputy general manager at the Festival Hall, got the job, Stuart Bacon, got the job of running the Sydney Opera House before it was opened. He was responsible for building it up and getting it open. And when Len approached me in London, he said, would I like this job? And I said, yes, all sounds fine. And then I didn't hear anything from him. And then I saw the Sydney Opera House job advertised. And I thought, that's the one for me. So I applied, and cut a very long story short, I did not get the job. I'm told that, I can't prove it, but I'm told that I was recommended for the position, but that they decided very sensibly, but rather late in the day, that they wanted an Australian to run the show. So I didn't get it. So then I went back then I thought, well, that's the end of my flirtation with Australia. And then Len came back to me rather on bended knee, it seemed, to say that they were still looking for somebody, and they were still looking for somebody not only for the Festival Centre, which is the one that he'd approached me about initially, but also for the festival. So I thought, well, both jobs would be nice. And I was asked if I would be willing to talk to Don Dunstan when he was coming to London. I said I'd be delighted. And as I walked over Hungerford Bridge from the south to the north bank of the Thames during my lunch hour from the Festival Hall to South Australia House, I thought to myself, yes, that's what I need to do. I need to demand both jobs. I did. And Don, who had this extraordinary habit when you were talking to him about anything important of not commenting at all, but simply saying, yes, 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 as you spoke to him, said yes. And I thought, well, I'm sunk. And there are two versions, I won't bore you with, about why he said yes. But anyway, he said yes within 20 minutes of my meeting him. He did point out that whilst the Festival Centre job was in the power of the government to offer me, and therefore he did so right then, the festival was a private organisation. It was in financial trouble. It had been to him for a bailout, which he had given them, but that he could not, in all conscience, offer me that job. But he said, I promise you that if you come to Adelaide for the other job to run the Festival Centre, before you've been here for more than a few months, you will have the other one too. And for some extraordinary reason, after 20 minutes of meeting this man, I trusted him. And that's exactly what happened.
And then you arrive here. What did you find?
I found a small provincial town in which I was, at that time, probably only second in importance to the Premier. I enjoyed that, and I made the most of it. And I never looked back from my own point of view. As far as I was concerned, this was a great opportunity. It was a marvellous, and still is, a marvellous complex. There's nothing, practically, that you can say after 37 years against the Adelaide Festival Centre, unless you decide... unless you decide that all such things are so out of date that they ought to be, you know, destroyed. It is a wonderful centre. It was marvellously designed. It was very carefully thought out. I had nothing to do with any of this, I hasten to say. It is just a very good place. And I was so proud and excited to be in charge of it. I enjoyed that time hugely.
I worked in a very, very minor capacity in the Festival Centre, round 75, 76, 77.
Was I your boss?
At a very, very long distance. You were right at the heart of the building and I was out staging things for small children on the Hayek Plaza. But I have treasured a memory of you, Anthony, which I later discovered by mentioning to Anthony was entirely spurious because it could never have happened, which is Anthony in his caftan on a skateboard crossing the plaza of the Festival Centre at great speed at the opening of a festival.
He'd obviously been ingesting illegal substances. I've never mounted a skateboard in my life.
But you did wear a caftan.
Yes, I did, yes.
But it seems to me that what I created over the years was a very effective metaphor of style, originality, speed, and the ability to take a risk that was at the core of your arrival here in Adelaide and those very first festivals.
You see, I had a huge advantage because I came from London. And when I arrived in Adelaide, I discovered, this is my opinion, I'm not saying it's right at all, but I discovered, I discovered that from my point of view, things were pretty traditional here, and that people needed waking up, particularly during the festival. So I did that, and I enjoyed doing that very much indeed, but of course, it didn't meet with universal approval, as you can imagine. So I had my disagreements less with the public than with the media, who were then even more awful than they are now.
Well, obviously you've managed to educate the arts media in Adelaide to a broader appreciation of what the arts mean. When you look at those first festivals, what do you feel were the biggest risks, and were there a few things that didn't quite fulfill your desire for them?
There were very many things that didn't fulfill my ambitions for an arts festival. Certainly there were, because it takes an enormous amount of time to change a machine of that kind. For example, and it's only one example off the top of my head, the ABC in those days felt that they had complete control, or they did, they were right, they had complete control over what the music part, or certainly what the orchestral musical part of any festival program consisted of. I didn't think this was right. There was nobody very interesting at the ABC at the time, I dare to say, and this is the federal ABC, of course, and one had to accept, or one was expected to accept, whatever was offered. They owned the orchestras, they offered the orchestra, they offered a program, you accepted that program, or you rejected that program. So on the whole, you were inclined to accept it, obviously. That takes a lot of overthrowing, and that was my main aim, was to overthrow that kind of attitude as completely and as quickly as I could.
Well, evidently...
Did I answer your question?
Yes, I think. You answered several of them because you've pointed to the importance of long-term planning and diplomacy, charm, style, the ability to persuade people to do what you want them to do by persuading them that it was their idea in the first place.
That perhaps came later. I was a bit more direct than that to begin with, I think, because I disliked the whole machine that existed to such an extent that I was impatient. But later on, I nearly said I mellowed. I hope I didn't, but at least I learned that it is better, obviously, to make it seem as if the good ideas came from the other side.
And it brings me to, of course, the book, Painful in Daily Doses. How did the title come about?
You're not supposed to know that till you read the book, but I'll tell you tonight, and that is that when I left Adelaide for purely personal reasons in 1970, immediately after the 78 festival, the media, somebody from the media, was interviewing my then chairman of the festival and said, what was he like working with? And the wonderful answer from Bruce Macklin came, like a shot in the arm, stimulating but painful in daily doses. And he was absolutely right, of course, because I had been extremely painful to the Adelaide establishment.
You went away, you came back, and in the interim, while we, of course, see you in the context of the Adelaide Festival, there was your work in Los Angeles, your work in other Australian capitals, your work in Malaysia. Now, that's an area, it had a certain colonial relationship to Australia. Colonel Light laid out Singapore, for example, and you did stay at Raffles Hotel. But that's a very different culture to move into to create an arts festival. What was that like?
It was one of the most wonderful and at the same time irritating challenges that I've ever had. I was asked to go, for reasons that I won't bore you with, to run the Singapore Festival, which at the time was a very small-scale, largely amateur organization, and Mobil Oil, who were the main sponsors, wanted to jack it up considerably. And for some reason or other, which I won't, as I say, bore you with, I was asked if I would direct the next Singapore Festival. So off I went, not realizing exactly what I was letting myself in for, because in that extraordinary city-state, which then, of course, was still run by Lee Kuan Yew, there was no such thing as a professional arts organization. There was one, and that was the Singapore Symphony Orchestra. But other than that, They were all, some of them extremely good, amateur organizations. And part of my job, I felt, was to make these organizations work together. For example, I remember going to one dinner party, which was very difficult for me because it was to do with Chinese theater, and they were all Chinese educated rather than English educated, so none of them spoke English except one person who was sitting next to me. And somehow, by the end of that evening, I'd managed to persuade 14 different Singaporean Chinese language theatre companies to work together, which had never happened before in the history of the city-state. So there was this kind of challenge, which I enjoyed very much because I didn't know what I was doing, so I couldn't really make any huge mistakes in my eyes. And the other part of the job, I felt, was to introduce very good work from the West, which I felt in my, didn't really know what I was talking about, but I felt might be attractive to the audiences in Singapore. So this was a pretty extraordinary challenge, really, and I was responsible to the Ministry of Culture, which was run by a whole lot of Chinese who wouldn't have known, I was going to say Shakespeare from Beethoven, but why should they do, really? But they were not arts people at all, they were bureaucrats. And it was a very, very difficult and challenging, at the same time, hugely enjoyable operation. It only lasted for one festival because we produced one theatrical production which didn't go down well with the authorities, to put it mildly. I think that's why I was never engaged again. But on the other hand, as you can imagine, it was not only the best thing in the program from my point of view, it was also the best program, best thing in the program from the point of view of those who took part in it. It was a large, I won't tell you the details, but it was a very large musical theater production, entirely amateur Singaporean performers. I asked my then landlord in Sydney at the time, John Tasker, the director for whom I have a great deal of time and who I knew worked extremely well with amateurs, to direct it. And on the first night, when I sat behind the little Indian man who was the Minister for Culture, and I felt I could almost see the hairs on the back of his head coming up in fury at the content of this piece. But the cast told me afterwards at the after party that they'd most of them been in tears because it was the first time in their lives that they'd felt not Tamil, Chinese or Malay, but Singaporean. And that was the greatest compliment that I received during my time in Singapore.
And it brings me, Anthony, to a remark which crops up many times in the book about the nature of works which you feel are suitable for a festival of arts, the things that actually make a festival. You talk about Stephen Sewell, for example, as a playwright, writing the sort of play which has, well, what are the things you feel a work for a festival should have? What are things you look for when you program a festival?
I think the short answer is that you say what, you ask, what do I find are the suitable things for a festival of arts? And the short answer is those things that are not suitable for that audience.
So something with, as in the Singaporean case, shock value as well as novelty?
Yeah. Not shock value, but something that shocks for better reasons than that. Something that shocks, something that makes them sit up and listen or watch, something that they probably don't like when they're watching it, something that they might not even like after they've watched it, but something above all that makes them think. Because Otherwise, why have a festival? The great thing about festivals is that you can take advantage of the fact that they are, that awful modern word, an event. People love events. They will come to an event to see something or hear something that they wouldn't go within a million miles of during the rest of the year. And as a festival director, I think you have a huge responsibility to take the greatest possible advantage of that situation that you can.
You do make the point that two of the festivals you're most fond of in your career lost money, or that they returned a deficit, shall we say. Investment in a festival is something that any state government really should put some thought to.
They do put thought to it. They put thought to it almost exclusively because of its result, perhaps, at the ballot box. They don't put any thought into it from the point of view of what is good for art. And that is one of the great problems in Australia, but not only Australia, of course. Nowadays, I think that governments get more and more and more generous towards the arts for all the wrong reasons.
There is in the book a page, a bit, of quotes by two people whose opinions you really respect on the virtue of the arts, the importance of the arts. One of them is, of course, the artist Whistler. But I'd like to bring this part of the evening to a close before we ask for questions from the floor, because I really think that the Claire Fox quote and the James McNeill Whistler quote sum up so much of what you believe.
This is a...
That one there?
Yeah. Yes. This is from a chapter which starts off, if I can find it, by saying, it's called Yes, Minister. It starts off by saying, somewhere in this narrative, I have to face up to my experience of dealing with and participating in Australian arts bureaucracies and the governments they serve. Not in my case, an occurrence normally brimming with anecdotes, because remember, this is called an anecdotal memoir. But in any case, here goes. And then it's quite a long chapter, and it consists largely of the text of a lecture I gave to one of your sister organizations, I suppose I might say, a couple of years ago. It was the 75th anniversary of the Friends of the Library of South Australia, State Library. And this is how it ends up. By the way, the lecture consisted very largely of complaints about government attitudes to the arts, but it did so very specifically by quoting other people, so it didn't look as if it was just me having a bitch. It was people who knew what they were talking about, not only from here, but from America and the United Kingdom, and this is how it finished. To sum up, I hand over to Claire Fox, director and founder of a British think tank, the Institute of Ideas. In Sydney this year to give a speech to a forum at the Centre for Independent Studies, she said, I've been accused of elitism for defending expertise and for arguing that authority gained from acquired insights and knowledge is more insightful than subjective prejudices. I've been called an elitist for arguing against the proposition that J.K. Rowling's Harry Potter books are as good as Jane Austen's, or for arguing that Beethoven is superior music to hip-hop. And I've been called an elitist for arguing that degrees in media studies, golf studies, and tourism are not as rigorous as degrees in physics, English literature, or the classics. In other words, you can be branded an elitist if you don't buy the fashion for cultural relativism, that pernicious orthodoxy that refuses to distinguish between the second-rate and the excellent. Contemporary elitism is a con, and at its heart lies a real scorn for ordinary people dressed up in the language of democratization. My lecture to the Friends of the State Library ended up with these words: "Let us not despair, though, if we sometimes fear for the future of the arts. As James McNeill Whistler remarked, art happens. No hovel is safe from it. No prince may depend upon it. The vastest intelligence cannot bring it about, and puny efforts to make it universal end in quaint comedy and coarse farce."
Anthony, thank you very much indeed.